Hey everyone, it's Mike from Media 1099 doing a little wrap-up of our most recent interview with Southern California photojournalist Michael Goulding. For this recording, I am not joined by my regular co-host Robert Husky because he had an actual job to do, which makes me feel just a little worse about myself than I already did, so thank you for that. In any case, this was an interview I was very much looking forward to. I myself do not come from a photojournalism background, either from teaching or from experience, so to discuss such a broad spectrum of journalistic concepts with Mike was really awesome. He is an easy guy to talk to, and he certainly has the credentials to talk anything photography related. We talk a little bit about his newspaper background, which is very diverse, about ethics, about teaching, and about building a strong portfolio. So if you're a photojournalist, stick with us. We've got a quick sponsor ad coming up, and then my interview with Michael Goulding will kick off right after the break. All right, good morning, creatives. Welcome to the Media 1099 podcast. Today's topic is a really important one. It's about photojournalism, something that I've rarely ever broached on this program before. So to help me out with that subject today, I brought in award-winning photojournalist Michael Goulding, who has worked with the newspaper industry for many years, covering stories that span the Olympic Games, to political protests, to dog surfing competitions in Huntington Beach. We're going to dive into all of that and what it takes to be the best photojournalist you can be. He is currently an educator at Cal State University Long Beach, teaching advanced photojournalism in film and digital, and you can view his work at mikegouldingphotography.com. I will leave that in the show notes as well. Honestly, folks, every conversation I've ever had with this gentleman, I have treasured and enjoyed. He is a fantastic photographer, a selfless teacher, and probably the only person I know who has actually ripped apart my work without making me feel bad about it. So to that end, we are in for a real treat. I thank you so much, Mike, for being here. Appreciate you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael. That's quite an introduction. If I'd known, I would have tried harder to insult you.
But, I know, right?
Well, let me just make one little amendment. I also teach high school. I'm teaching high school now up at Sunny Hills, which is in Fullerton, California.
Oh, fantastic.
I really get a kick out of that age group, and I really get a kick out of what they show me coming out of their cameras and in their pictures. So that's a real treat. I didn't want to forget them.
Yeah, absolutely. And elaborate on that a little bit. What is it about high school students that maybe provide a different energy than, let's say, collegiate students or people like myself coming to the sports shooter workshop that are a little bit older? Is there a difference there that you can kind of feel?
Well, I think there's a naivete and an innocence in the way they see. And these days in particular with the phones and everybody has a camera in their hand. But until they start to see how they can really kind of shape the imagery, they really get a sense of discovery when a picture really, no pun intended, clicks. And they really kind of, it all kind of comes together. And that's a really exciting time for me to see when I show enthusiasm over a picture they went out to shoot for shallow depth of field. And I go a little gaga over it, and they're just in wonder, and I tell them what a great picture it is, and their eyes kind of light up, and it's just really exciting to kind of see the true discovery of photography in someone's eyes. So that part of it I like a lot. I have a kind of a maybe unique respect for their age group. I have two children. They're both 25 and 27 now. And so I'm a long way from teenage years, but I like the age group, and I particularly like this generation. I see in this generation a lot of there's not a lot of bias. There's not a lot of they all seem to appreciate each other as human beings. They may not like each other, the cliques are all there and high school is high school, but I get a sense that they're just a little bit more open with their fellow man. And I like that about them. There's just some understanding there that I'm certain wasn't there when I was in high school. So that's kind of fun to be around too. And being around youth is always invigorating and keeps you young. So, right. I don't know. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Did you always know that you were going to go, and you have extensive experience, especially with the Orange County Register, but you started in newspapers before that. Did you always know that you're going to go that path?
With education?
No, I think with newspaper.
Oh, with newspaper. Well, you know, my father was is a former editor at the Los Angeles Times. He was actually, he was working on the city desk when the Times won their Pulitzer for the Watts riots. Oh, wow. So he'd been there for many, many years. And I just have this this memory and past where I come from a big family. I have five brothers and sisters, and we always had these family dinners. And, you know, every night it was, you know, everybody sitting around the table, and he would tell stories about different things that happened at the newsroom that day or in the news or things that were just going on. And I just had always had a fascination for that. So, yeah, I guess so. I see myself heading for journalism. And then he'd bring home these books once a year called Just One More, which was the annual book that the LA Press Photographers Association would put out, or I guess it's the Press Photographers Association of Greater Los Angeles now. And I would go through those books. I'd pore over those books and just think that was the coolest thing in the world. And though I didn't really get into shooting pictures till I was my first year in college, I really loved the craft. And I just marveled at what people were able to do with their photographs and the way they connected to me. So, the short answer to which is too late, but yeah, I found myself heading that way, and I just saw the power of photography early, and it really hooked with me. So I really wanted to explore that. So when it presented itself as a photography class at Fullerton Community College, I knew where I was heading.
Well, I guess that was my next question: is who taught you photography? Was it your father? Was it a class? Was it a school?
Oh no, my father was words all the way. I have a little sister who followed that path. She became an editor at the Times for a stint. But I was taught, my first class was, just to show you my desire, my first class was 7 o'clock in the morning. It was one day a week. It was for 3 hours. It was in a basement of an old building that has now been destroyed on Fullerton JC's campus. And it was just kind of taught by an older gentleman who liked to show the class pictures from his cruise ship excursions. So that's about as deep as we got into photojournalism. But he's the one who showed me how to process in the trays and load the reels and how to work with filters and what depth of field was. But a lot of it was just kind of, here it is, I'm going to show you this, but then, you know, the only way you're really going to grasp it is through practical application. So I took my little Canon FTB and my 50 millimeter lens and went out and did it myself. And then we'd come back and talk about it, but not very much, really. It was more about, you know, just the process or just the act of making the picture. And even to this day, I think that's really important that pictures aren't learned in the classroom. They're learned on the street. They're learned through experience. And that's probably my favorite part of the whole craft is just getting out there and being part of life and recording that.
Was there a certain point after just messing around as a student, going and trying to discover that process, kind of almost like an actor, like, you know, you figure out what your process is. Did you at any point figure, okay, this is now something that I really kind of feel like I have a handle on or I gravitate more to? Because there's many niches in photography that you could have gone. I guess what's about photojournalism that resonates so strongly with you, and how did you find that?
Well, I think the culture of journalism that I grew up with, you know, there was always magazines, there was always newspapers, there was always some kind of flow of information coming into our house. And the journalism was a huge part of just who the Gouldings were, you know, all eight of us. And so that was always kind of there. But I think what really attracted me was the freedom that comes with journalism, and your ability to kind of confine chaos and make a message out of it, and be able to tell a story in a picture. So I think journalism was always kind of where I was heading with my camera. As much as I love the, you know, there's nothing better than a great portrait, or more to the point, a great advertising photography or a campaign. I mean, they're just, I don't mean to diminish those or say that that wasn't what I was interested in, because I certainly tried to explore that side of things when I would illustrate or do food photography later on in my photojournalism career. But when I was first starting out, all I wanted to do was get, I wanted to be out where the action was. Mm-hmm. I wanted people to pay me to do cool stuff.
Right.
Like go to concerts and sporting events and witness sporting events. I mean, I've always loved sports. I played sports in high school, and I've always loved sports. So that's another, it was another hook for me. But I think that what really attracted me was that I was just kind of, there was no real confinement. I could go out and make whatever picture I thought told the story. And it seemed, you know, it seemed to work. You know, people liked my pictures. So I just kept kind of doing my thing, you know.
Do you remember your first assignment?
Well, my first assignment for the San Gabriel Valley Tribune, this is my first professional assignment, was in early September, I think it was. And they sent me out to the LA County Fair to photograph a guy who was a sculptor with a chainsaw. And back when that wasn't a real, you know, that was a pretty new thing. So it was a guy who was, you know, like would carve a bear out of a tree trunk or something. And that was my big breakthrough. That was my hard hitting story.
What did you learn in that first assignment that kind of stuck with you? Is there anything that you can tell us about that?
I guess it was talking to the person rather than just watching the person. Cause I did that when I first got there. I was, you know, I was nervous and maybe a little intimidated, but, you know, and I just wanted to kind of hang back. But then after a while, we ended up chatting and talking, and it just kind of helped me kind of get an idea of who this guy was. I think it made my pictures just a little deeper, and it's something I brought back from that assignment that I've used since.
Talk to me about like kind of this balance, because I always had this vision of photojournalists being really socially awkward because they want to stay away from people, but like just take pictures. And so there's this natural sense for me to be like, they don't like engaging with people as much, because your job description is to kind of be that fly on the wall. But how do you kind of reconcile that when you do have to engage with the subject and you do have to introduce yourself or just navigate that space?
Well, the trick is being in the space, but not being in the space.
Yeah.
It's not that hard, as I'm having a hard time answering this question, but it's, you just, you know, you're cordial, and you're, and no one likes a lurker, mm-hmm. You know, no one likes someone who's just kind of, it depends on the situation too. I mean, if you're in a war zone, there's not a whole lot of time for chat.
Right.
But if you're working on, you know, you're working with a parents whose child is waiting for some kind of treatment and it's a rare disease, and, you know, you spend a lot of time with that family, you can't help but bond with that family, and or at least be cordial and nice and make conversation. If you're just sitting there, it detracts. And I think that just making people feel comfortable is important. And I think it depends on the assignment. Like I've just given you two examples, pretty extreme, where you're with somebody almost nonstop and you're with different people. And then the other example is with your different people every second. And so, you know, you just work accordingly. But I think being a decent human being, being someone with some social skills, mm-hmm. is always helpful. Or, you know, a chat or maybe a little joke, depending on the situation. But just to be human. Right. I've heard that too, that photographers can be a bit reclusive. And I know there are some, and I think there are different fields where that is more prevalent than others. I think a lot of guys like, a lot of people like to shoot sports because there isn't a whole lot of interaction. It's a lot of long lenses and mm-hmm. distance. And then there's people who just thrive on working the story when you're working shoulder to shoulder with your subject and, you know, living life with them.
Right.
And both are wonderful. And I think one of the real attractions for me and newspapers has always been that we're not confined to one particular type of journalism or another. We get it all. And it's you never know what your day is going to be. I worked for a year, maybe a little less than a year, for an all sports newspaper called The National. And I thought, man, this is going to be great. Nothing but sports. And even something like that, it's like getting too much chocolate. Even that, you start getting a little tired of the chocolate. Right. So, and then you realize that you too want those stories where you are interacting, where you're meeting these great people who get up every day and you know, train guide dogs for people who have, who need assistance, things like that, where you're getting these cool human interest stories as well as these great moments in sports. God, Michael, I'm sorry. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, no, yeah. Do you have a favorite assignment or piece that you did? There one that kind of stands out as like, that was a really unique and kind of beautiful moment to capture.
Well, there's I was thinking about that. I read your list and I was looking, you know, there's different events, you know, as a sports photographer that I'll never forget. One is the 4x4 medley relay in China and swimming. And Michael Phelps was on his big run to get all those gold medals. I can't remember how many he won, but he had, I think everything he swam in, he won. And in this case, it was 4x4x100 medley relay, as each swimmer does a different stroke. And the last guy into the water was a fellow that no one had heard of, on the Jason Lezak, who was from Irvine, which was a big excitement for me being the Orange County Register photographer. But he essentially won that race and kept Michael Phelps' string alive as far as the gold medals go. And he came from behind against the French, and the place was just explosive. I'm getting goosebumps talking about it. Go ahead.
Yeah, you recognized in that moment, because you were, I know you're doing your job, but you're also still like plugged into, there are records on the line here. This is something historic. So you're kind of tuned into the Michael Phelps storyline while you're there, right?
Oh yeah, you need to be. You have to be aware. But you should not be an uninformed photographer showing up at any event, whether it's a puppy giveaway or a gold medal race. It's you need to have some awareness. You need to be. Your pictures get deeper that way. You're not just capturing superficial situations. You're really telling stories in the truest sense of the word. And we knew that was what was going on with Michael Phelps, and that worked out really well. Another thing was before those same Olympics, I did the time trials up in Oregon, in University of Oregon, and there was a 1500 meter race, and three guys from Oregon were in it. And on the last lap, all three of them were at the beginning of the last lap. All three of them were in last place. And by the end of that lap, all three of them had qualified for the Olympics.
Oh, wow.
And they'd done it. And they're all Oregon. They're all University of Oregon guys. So the place went absolutely nuts, with the finish ending up with the last guy to qualify diving across the finish line. And when you see things like that, and you record things like that, you know, you realize how lucky you are to be in the position that you have, that you're making these pictures, and the pressure is there, which keeps you alert and makes you get the picture. But mostly it's just appreciating the endeavor and the effort and the excitement. And it was just amazing. It was one of those magic, you know, it was in the magic hour of the day. It was like 6:30 in the evening, and up at this beautiful, you know, historic track. And then you see that happen. It was just remarkable. It was just amazing.
It kind of reminds me, there's this really interesting frame that you have on your website, and I think it's Rio, where Michael Phelps is in first place. The guy right next to him is kind of looking at him as he trails. And this frame, or variations of this frame, have been like actually memed about for years, you know, where they say like winners focus on winning and losers focus on winners. So I'm kind of curious, were you ever aware of that trend? And two, did you ever wake up and see someone else's version of that and then just kind of get angry that they didn't steal your frame instead?
Well, if there were money involved, I might have been angry. Right. But unfortunately, in most cases like that, there's never money involved. Mm-hmm. But well, that was the guy who was talking smack about Michael Phelps, and he got schooled that night. That's the first time I really remember how advanced the internet had become and how social media had come into play. Because until then, I don't really remember comparing pictures from from photographers who posted who were sitting next to me. And I looked at my picture and was really happy with it. And then inevitably you see someone else's picture and you kind of go, oh, maybe I should have done that, or maybe I should have done this. When in fact, the picture I made was pretty darn good.
Yeah. And it's so difficult because you're all relatively close proximity to each other. And so it might just be like a split second off between the two.
Yeah. Yeah. Or that guy's 5 feet up the riser from me.
Exactly.
So he had a little bit better of an angle, that there's just nothing you can do about it. But that particular case is when I realized in Rio that Instagram and social media was really coming into its own, because, you know, you'd be riding back after a long day on the bus, you know, to get back to the press center, and everybody's posting their stuff, and you're what you thought was a really good day kind of starts to dim a little bit. You know? Oh shit, how did you get that? You
know, yeah, that it is comparison culture. But yeah, that it just kind of made me laugh, because
I haven't heard that before. That's good.
Yeah, that picture or versions of that picture are probably up on high school locker rooms as a poster, you know, so it's just funny. You've had the good fortune to like cover a lot of glamorized events, you know, so it's either presidential campaigns or Olympics or even Super Bowls. What event did you feel like most underwhelmed by, and what event really lived up to the billing?
Underwhelmed. I'd say I really wanted to do a political convention, and I was really underwhelmed by it. Mm-hmm. It was the one in LA when Al Gore got nominated against George W. And I had all these great ideas. You know, I thought it was going to be zany people, but you know, I think it used to be more so, to the point where most networks don't even carry that much of them anymore. So I was kind of underwhelmed by what I saw and what was required, my access and stuff like that. So I would have to, I'd go there just off the top of my head. Mm-hmm.
And is there something that really almost exceeded expectations? That it's like, okay, the Super Bowl, you assume one thing and then you get there and it's even bigger and better than you thought?
I think the Olympics was that for me. I just couldn't get over how much fun the Olympics were, and how exciting they were. And, you know, it's big, and you've been watching it since you're a little kid. I remember watching the Mexico Olympics. I remember Juan Carlos throwing his fist up in the air. But when I got there, it was just so much cooler. Because even in spite of, you know, there's always this cluster of elite who get to wear the green vest, who get to go to the special places, you know, and I'm not part of that. You know, I'm working for a newspaper. I'm I'm covering five events a day, usually different venues all over the city. But it also taught me to shoot, to make pictures that no one had thought of. You know, a lot of times you get those pictures or you get those situations at the Olympics where, okay, this is where the picture's going to happen. So all the green vests get to go there. Well, if you're a photographer if you want to be a good photographer, you figure out a way around that, which is kind of what I based my, you know, the way I like to think of myself. But what I loved about the Olympics that I was surprised by is not only is it the greatest athletes in the world that are there doing amazing things, is that you're with shooting with some of the best photographers ever. Mm. And it brings your game up, just like the athletes who are there bring their game up by looking at, you know, Usain Bolt. And maybe they'll never beat him, but they'll certainly, you know, give him a good run for their money because they're there. So I'd say that is probably one thing where I walked into the Olympics and was so jazzed to be there every day. You know, you get like 4 hours, 5 hours of sleep every day, but you're out of bed, you're up, you're ready to go. And it's just a kick in the ass, just a, really a lot of fun the whole time.
Yeah. Nothing like shooting shoulder to shoulder with some of your heroes. And
So true. It's so mm-hmm. true. Yeah.
How much do you think about, I don't know if this is over intellectualizing things, but like, is there a delineation between shooting for the audience, right? Like the viewer, the person that's going to pick up the newspaper and look at it on their lunch break and trying to make pictures for that person versus making pictures for yourself or making pictures for your actual client? Or does it all kind of meld into just, I just do my job?
Oh, I don't know that I've ever thought of it as just doing my job. I think what I want to say is that I've always kind of shot for the community. Let me figure out how to say this. Mm-hmm. I think that the pictures I make are the pictures that the community wants to see, and right. So I try my hardest to make an interesting, evocative, storytelling, big moment picture, because that's what I'd want to see picking up the newspaper. Mm-hmm. And as long as that photograph is honest and exciting or different or pretty or humorous or ironic or sad, if it brings some emotion, I think that's what people want to see.
Right.
And so I thought, you know, to hear your question, I haven't heard that before, but I think what I want to show is what I want to see, and so it's a pretty good combo.
Yeah, I kind of fall into that same category. I was just always interested by that because sometimes, for someone that is not in journalism but more towards marketing, I tend to find myself in conflict of interest of shooting for my own kind of creative satiation, but as also for a client that I have to shoot for or the end audience, and they could be different things. But yeah, like I think that the most genuine spots tend to be from shooting for yourself as if you are part of that community. What would you right. want to see? Yeah.
Right. And I think that's the beauty of newspapers that's going to get lost, is that those people who work for newspapers aren't just some elite, you know, news organization. They're your neighbors. They're people who are your community. And right. I think that's important to remember.
This is an interesting one. I was thinking about this morning.
Let me just say one more thing.
Yeah.
Because it kind of melds the two worlds. Because one of the nicest things about, until this, because of the virus, I'm not shooting the fair this year. And one of the most fun clients I've had that I work in during the summer when I'm not teaching is the fair. And part of the reason I think we get along so well, or why they like my work so much, where they had a board meeting where they didn't even talk about numbers from the fair. All they did was show my pictures.
Oh, wow.
To denote the success of the year. So of the last fair, which made me really, really happy and very proud and all that. But But it was also because they just let me, the woman I work for there, Terry Moore, she's awesome. I've worked for her at the Register before she left the Register. Now she's at the fair. She just said, just show me the fair. That's all I want to see. Yeah. So what's great about that is that we're not just showing you people with their pies and a blue ribbon. We're showing you the making of the pie and the mm-hmm. people's reaction to that. So in that sense, it's kind of a blend of both, you know, where your client's imagery or your client's message is displayed through pictures that, you know, it's me as the expert. And in that case, it works out really, really well.
That's a dream scenario. And it's not that it's unrealistic. It happens, like, you know, and but that's such a great feeling is when the client says, just go make pictures and get the feel of the event, get the feel of the fair. Like, I think you do a great job of that. That's the Orange County Fair that we're talking about. But yeah, that's such a wonderful sweet spot to be in, don't you think?
Oh, I do. I do. Everybody wins. You know, the people at the fair win, the people who run the fair win.
Yeah.
And the guy who shoots the fair, you know, it keeps them coming back. It keeps me coming back. Every day, it's just like doing journalism, you know. Right. Every day is going to be different, and I don't know what to expect, but I'm going to capture it.
Do you get shot lists either for the newspaper or for the Orange County Fair or throughout your career? Has that always been something there, or do you just get a general overview of what we're looking for and you just kind of run with it?
Well, at the fair, there is a shot list, and I that's like a part of it, and then the other part is what we were just talking about.
Yeah.
So I mean, there's certainly things that big clients want their booth shot. Things like that.
Right.
Sponsors
and.
Yeah, sponsor. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, we got to have, you know, they don't have to tell me most of this stuff. They'll say, well, we really need the 4-H auction on Saturday, blah, blah, blah. Well, there isn't a way in the world I'm not going to go shoot a bunch of kids selling their animals, you know? So
right.
It's a shot list, but it's more or less common sense that we're going to shoot it. I'm going to shoot it anyway, but that's just, you know, stops things from falling through the cracks, which I appreciate because, you know, you can get lost, you know, chasing your own vision. And particularly in commercial, you really can't afford to do that. So
do you usually kind of stick to a routine of, okay, I'm going to follow the shot list. And then once there's kind of 80% done of that, I can kind of start to go play? Or are you balancing and juggling both of those concepts at the same time?
I'm doing both at the same time, but I mean, I'm always looking for pictures. I mean, the shot list is kind of always there, but if something presents itself that I think is a picture or that is a situation that will yield pictures, I can put the shot list away for just a bit and work that. Mm-hmm. The shot list is kind of a nice way to work your way through the fair. So you make sure to cover all the bases. And while you're doing that, it's just like as a journalist, you know, you're being sent to cover, you know, the opening of a new firehouse in Irvine, but on your way there, you see, you know, a bunch of kids playing on a slip and slide with a black background behind it. So all the water's going to pop. So you stop for 10 minutes.
Right.
You know, it doesn't stop you from going to the firehouse, but you also, it puts you in an opportunity to make pictures that you wouldn't have found yourself in the first place.
It reminds me of something that you said a couple years ago, I think it was, during a presentation. You talked about, one, how photographers have such a more visually rich life than non-photographers. And I thought that was really beautiful and that resonated with me because it's true. I think we do stop and see things nonstop. Like it doesn't shut off. And I remember hearing you talk about you'll be at a stoplight and just kind of start to see a tableau unfold, but you know, before your eyes. Walk me through what that process is like and what that gives you in terms of flexibility as being a photographer that you can go beyond that shot list. You know, you have something extra because you're always seeing things.
Well, tell me if this gets going too long, but the genesis of that whole thought process was I was assigned to photograph Annie Leibovitz, a famed portrait photographer, and as it turns out, an amazing photojournalist before she, you know, got paid a ton of money by American Express and people. But I was sent to photograph her for a show she was doing in Santa Monica. This is 30 years ago. And we got to talking after I was done photographing her. And she said, I don't know how you photojournalists do it. I mean, how do you ever turn it off? Aren't you always just seeing pictures? And I got to thinking, I didn't pay much attention to that at the time. But on the way home that night, I got to thinking, yeah, we do see pictures all the time. And that's a good thing in my mind. I love the fact that we're always witnessing. And that kind of brought me to that, you know, the presentation you're talking about, because I was at the Sports Shooter Academy, which I know you've had Bert Hanashiro on here and Matt Brown on here. And I did that presentation, and I kind of came up with the idea that if you're going to, you have to be seen all the time. And in order to shoot better, I think you need to see better. So that's kind of where that phrase came from. But I also think that part of the attraction for me and for all photographers, I think, should be that you live a more visually rich life as a photographer. You witness, or you notice things that most people will just walk by. You know, you will be able to appreciate a sunset at a richer level because you'll notice that the sunset isn't over after the sun hits the horizon.
Yep.
There's another hour after that that makes amazing pictures, and you get to witness those things. Mm-hmm. So to get back to your point, I think we do see pictures a lot. And I think that's it's a wonderful thing. I hope I'm giving this the...
Absolutely. Yeah.
But it's also a bit like, you know, Yo-Yo Ma probably hears music at a much richer essence than I will ever hear.
Of course. Yep.
And not to compare my photography with Yo-Yo's Ma's musicianship, because there is none. But I think I see things better or differently than people who haven't been trained visually. And I consider myself very fortunate for that.
Sticking with Annie Leibovitz, you got to tell me, is there an anecdote there? Is it beyond what you've already told me? What was that like? Were you scared shitless when you took a photograph of her? I mean, how does that
work? I'm not the only one cussing on this thing. well, you know, the picture I made of her that we used, was the second attempt. I came back. We had a press availability for the, you know, at the time I was working at the Breeze, which is in the South Bay. And I went up there to photograph her, and I was a nervous wreck. And my pictures showed I was a nervous wreck. And I'd been working, I've been making pictures for 10, you know, I've been a working journalist for 10 years by then. And I was so intimidated by her because I so love her work. And not only her portrait work, which everybody kind of knows as this conceptual portraits and that kind of thing. You ought to look at her work when she was a kid, you know, when she was growing up on military bases with her dad, who was in the Air Force. And then, you know, following the Rolling Stones and, you know, chronicling the summer of love up in San Francisco. She's just an amazing photojournalist. But anyway, I was assigned to do this portrait, and I completely pooched it. I just didn't like the pictures. They're just not what I wanted them to be. So I did something that I very rarely do, is I tracked her down and said, can I come back and do another shoot? And she was great. You know, was like 2 days later. She said, yeah, I'm going to be at the gallery about a half an hour before the show opens, show starts, and you can come in there and I'll give you 5 minutes. And so I drove back up there, and I'm just going, well, here I am. I've got my shot. And what am I going to do with it? So I pulled off the freeway, and I went to an Aaron Brothers and bought a big frame. And And I had her pose in that, and she was very excited about that. And I thought she was very excited because because of my idea, you know?
Right.
But then halfway through the shoot, she goes, "Oh yeah, so and so did this with so and so back in, you know, like 1944."
Ah, damn it.
Yeah, but you know.
Well, that's still a great story. Yeah. I would imagine that the anxiety actually for the second time around was maybe even worse, because you can't botch the second shoot, right?
No.
You weren't, so I mean, you have to nail it now. I mean, how was that anxiety? Was it just crazy or
pretty manageable? I think at the time. But on the other hand, I already had some pictures, so I could be a little bit more exploring.
Yeah.
And that might have helped a little bit. I also like the fact, you know, the first time I photographed her, she was kind of ready for pictures.
Yeah.
And the second time, she had just gotten out of the shower. It looked like her hair was back. It's a little more extreme, a little more edgy looking. So I was happy about that. And I just was not going to let myself fail. You know, I was just going to make damn sure that this worked.
Right.
And it did. So,
good.
You know,
it's a great photograph.
Well, thank you. It's just one of those things where I'm, you know, you look back on it and go, well, you were being kind of silly, but that's just the way I work. I get all, you know, my anxieties are usually my motivators.
Right. If this is interesting for me, is there a particular moment in history or a certain era that you wish you could like time travel back to and document?
Well, you can't look at Robert Frank without wishing you were there.
Mm.
You know, as a photojournalist, his pictures are so, so telling. And what I loved about him so much was that he was kind of dispelling the myth of America. And I just love that. We need more of that, by the way.
Yeah.
And let's see. I mean, as a like a, going back and being a photographer, a photojournalist in the Western days, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I suppose anything that you feel like is, you know, maybe either before the camera was ever invented and there's like a historic moment, or even that is after but is maybe under documented to some degree, and how you would enjoy the opportunity to capture some sort of either historic moment or just an era in general. Like, you know, I couldn't imagine photographing New York City without advertisements. Like, that would be interesting to me, you know.
Yeah.
Or is there anything that stands out to you, or is it just kind of not really jumping to mind?
I can't. It's not jumping into mind. But, yeah. You know, I do, when you say not without advertising, I can't help but think of the Neil Leifer picture that he made from
Of course, yeah.
From above,
yep.
With the knockout of Muhammad Ali standing over. I don't think that was Liston. It was somebody else.
That's my favorite Leifer photo.
Well, it's the only, you know, I worked for Neil Leifer at the National. He was the photo editor.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a little nerve wracking at times. But what he claims that's the only photograph he's made that he has in his house.
Really?
Yeah, because he says that was the perfect photograph for him.
I would agree.
And a big part of that speaks back to what you just said about New York is there was no advertising on the mat.
Yeah.
So it's just this beautiful, clean background or, you know, surrounding part of the composition that didn't get in the way. Now, hell, you can't do that without seeing Bud Light or
Yeah, totally ruined it. And I think too, back then the people were smoking in the stands, and so like there was this kind of haze that
you had this beautiful, it was capturing all the light. It was like throwing smoke out before a laser show.
What did Neil teach you in your time working for him?
Don't settle.
Yeah,
don't settle. I made some portraits that I thought were really nice. He said they, you know, he would point things out, and I would look at him. And go, yeah, he's right. You know, I mean, it's just not good enough to be good. You gotta, even if you can't achieve it, you gotta want to make it great.
Yeah, you gotta work it.
Yeah, and I think that's the most indispensable tool that a photojournalist can have is tenacity, is to just keep coming at it. Don't settle for what you shot the last time. Because, you know, if newspapers teach you anything, is you shoot the same thing over and over and over and over and over again, Right. It's like every year there's, you know, the dog surfing picture. Every year there's the big waves at the wedge. Every year there's, you know, something else. So the trick and the true hunt is to push yourself past what you've already made and make and go for great.
Do you think that the today's emphasis on getting images out fast, you know, you can't go past one round of a boxing match before they say we need images. Do you think that kind of in the social media era, the emphasis of getting photos out quick and instantaneously is kind of preventing photojournalists and artists from actually really from working the moment, working the event, working the assignment, because they are on a time crunch?
Well, that's true, but there's always been a time crunch. There's always been deadlines. But you know, your point is well taken. That you know the speed is the most important thing, and in sports, I think it's safer to be that way than you know covering a story or working an event, because you know that round is going to be over.
Yeah,
and the picture, you know, the moments are going to stop, and you can concentrate on the other part of the job. But what I think gets in the way of deep photography is the sheer number that photographers are required to produce. You know, the days of a 10 picture slideshow are over.
I mean, right.
These photographers will post 35 pictures. You can't make 35 pictures that are worth looking at.
No, that's true.
You know, why do I care about the way the guy ties his shoes? You know, it's just like it's finding minutia.
Right.
And instead of, you know, sitting there and cranking out 40 pictures, sit down, you know, be patient and wait and turn out 10, 15 that really bring you in, you know?
Right.
I think it's more number than speed.
Yeah.
I mean, speed is just the fact of the business, but you know, richness, I think, is what we lose when we try to provide too much.
Right. It's like subtraction by addition.
You know? Yes.
Yeah. Just out of curiosity, what was the amount that you were required to submit, like your first days at the OOC Register versus your last days at the OOC Register? Like, what was the volume change? Did it go from like 5 to all of a sudden 50 or what was that number?
Well, the volume change when I first got to the Register was... You know, we were shooting film, so we didn't have that pray and spray kind of thing.
Sure.
And we would, you know, it would be more incumbent upon the photographer how much film they wanted to shoot in order to capture the pictures, because you know you'd process your film and then you'd go out and look at it on a light table, and off that light table, you would determine what pictures you want to choose. We didn't have an internet, so the only real vehicle for seeing pictures was the newspaper. And so, you know, 1, 2, 3 pictures, 4 pictures, you know, 1 for the cover, a couple for the jump, and you're done. But it's mining for those 2 or 3 where you shot a lot of pictures. Mm-hmm. And it was on that light table where you determined that these are the 3 out of the 500 that you photographed that we're going to use. These days, you have so many pictures that it's harder to get down to those 2 or 3.
Right.
So I would say that not that much has changed as far as how many you photograph, but now it's how many you see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely. You mentioned once that you don't think there's any way for community to see itself quite so vividly as they do when they're in the newspapers. Could you elaborate on the uniqueness of that medium and how do you see it changing today?
Well, the uniqueness of newspapers are in the way they, you know, not to sound like the old farts we used to laugh at, but... that I've become, by the way. But it's unique. It used to be unique in that that this was a medium that was invited into people's homes. And That's there's even a couple ways of viewing that. I mean, you would have a relationship where you'd go out and photograph, and they would pay for it, and then you would deliver it to their homes, and they would look at it, and they'd see their community in their over on their, you know, kitchen table. And it was also a relationship that extended beyond that, I think, because of the relationship at the kitchen table, it was also a willingness within the community to deal with you as a photographer, as a journalist. So when those heartbreaking moments happened and you had to knock on someone's door for a story and come in, people would be apt to say, yes, please come in. And there was a sense, I always got a sense of community and responsibility from those relationships. And I think when, so I think it was pretty rich. And I think the pictures of the community coming into people's homes via, you know, an analog product is more personable than they are now. Again, because there are so many pictures.
Yeah.
And, you know, I read the amount of pictures that are posted on Instagram on a daily basis are in the billions.
Wow.
Whereas before, with newspapers and the old analog medium, and I'm not saying they're better, I'm just saying this is a different relationship, that they're a bit more special and a bit more unique. Mm-hmm. And now everything's mundane. And now it's not a question of whether there's a picture, it's a question of whether that picture is real. Mm-hmm. And there's just so much flow that I think we've lost a little bit of humanity and the commonality and the sense of community that comes through photojournalism.
Right. What kind of gear do you kind of work with when you're going to an assignment? I know it depends on if you're shooting a sport when you need long glass, but when you're photographing something somewhat journalistically, are you going as light as you can? Are you bringing two bodies? Are you normally shooting with primes or zooms? What kind of gear do you come to work with?
I started with a camera bag full of stuff, and I found myself over the years using less and less of it. And I think I just got comfortable with what I have, and mm-hmm. I knew what I could do with what I, you know, I liked the pictures I made with a certain setup. And the setup was generally was two cameras. And I'd have 17 to 35 on one camera. And then I'd have a 70 to 200 on another camera. And depending, you know, I'd have a 300 millimeter on my shoulder lens that I could swap out with the other stuff. And that would be it, you know. I would carry a little pouch that I'd put a teleconverter in for the 70 to 200 and for the 300 if I needed it. And that was pretty much it, you know, because the ISOs are getting so insanely good on the new cameras. I found myself using flash for effect rather than for need. And so if I wasn't shooting at night or if I wasn't in a situation where I thought I really need it, I stopped bringing it along with me. But having said that, I also want to point out that if I'm walking into a situation that's not, you know, kind of a light feature for a newspaper, if I'm going into some kind of news that could have news import to it, I was never without a flash. I mean, I was the guy who would show up at a Laker game and I'd have my flash charged because I was the guy who was convinced that the lights were going to go out.
Right.
Or we'd have some kind of blackout, or we'd have some kind of situation where I really needed a flash. And so I always had a flash with me. But other than that, it was all pretty light. Mm-hmm. Unless, you know, I was going for a certain effect. Like that, I shot a picture of opening football game between, you know, football season for high school, and they wanted something for A1. So I brought a fisheye and I tucked it into the coin toss. So, you know, specialty stuff. But day in and day out, I relied more on my savvy as a photographer than on my gear. And right. I think it's too easy to kind of get lost in your gear. I've never been one who really keeps track of, you know, all the different stuff. So
Yeah, a little too much paralysis by analysis.
Yeah. You got some great sayings.
I didn't come up with them. Talk to me about like the responsibilities that a photojournalist has for their work and the community. When you talk to your students about ethics of photojournalism, what are some of the kind of bullet point things that you go over? What do you make sure that they understand that if they're going to go into this, that they understand X, Y, and Z?
Well, first thing I tell them is that we are historians and that we, what we capture will tell people 100 years from now what it was like in a pandemic in 2020. And that needs to be accurate and truthful. And so I always stress upon them that we've got to be honest and we can't shade things in one way or another. So to the best of your ability, be honest with right. yourself and with the scene.
Is it difficult to transition from like a candid approach to a more documentary project where like the subject is aware of the camera and there is like a clear social message that the artist wants to convey? Is that difficult?
Ask me that a different way, because I'm not quite sure I understand.
So if you're a photojournalist, you know, you kind of just document the history of it, what's happening in front of you, as opposed to if you're doing some sort of feature piece with somebody and then you're, that subject is aware that they're going to be in front of the camera, that you are going to make a story. Is that difficult for a journalist to kind of reconcile, or is it just part of, here's another day, it's a different project?
No, well, it's something you have to be aware of, because, you know, like things that are happening in front of you and are documenting, it's more real, and you really, you know, you just react.
Yeah.
When you're doing a story, the temptation is always, you know, stories are very cool methods of story, you know, of journalism, but they can get tedious. That's the hard. I mean, to me, that's the hardest thing for me is, you know, to keep vigilant, and to keep yourself out of it, because it is easy to kind of fall in there. Case in point, I was doing a story on some kids who were doing a program through the Braille Institute, and they were transitioning into independent life, independent living. And a couple of times I had to tell this poor blind kid that, no, I'm not going to give you a ride to the office or to the store.
Right.
Because, you know, I'll go with you on the bus, but I'm not giving you a ride, because it would be contaminating the scene. I mean, there's arguments that even having a camera in a room alters it. And so accepting that, you have to be aware that you can't really start directing life.
Yeah.
And that sometimes is difficult.
Yeah, it becomes interesting. And I'm curious, because now we've obviously seen a tremendous surge in the volume of like social protesting in the country. The magnitude of these protests, to me, without any social commentary on the matter, feel very historic. So it goes without saying that photographers are going to be compelled to cover this even without an assignment attributed right. to them. So I'm curious, what kind of conversations, if any, did you have with your students about venturing into this space where the risk, the volatility of the situations are elevated and more unpredictable? Did you have those conversations?
We didn't, because, like I said, a lot of those happened after they'd left, or the school year was over. Mm-hmm. But I do stress that. Well, let's talk about this one thing that has kind of been in the news lately with photojournalists is that photographers, particularly college photographers or young photographers, who want to blur the faces of the demonstrators.
Right.
And there's a kind of a discussion about that. That's not your responsibility. So I tell them that. I mean, if I'm going to weigh in on this argument, it's going to be that you don't touch a picture to do that.
Right.
we are not, that's not our business. Our business is truth, and our business is telling people what's happening. If those people feel, vulnerable because they're being seen out there, well, then that's not my concern.
Right.
I that sounds cold, but it's true. It's not my concern. I'm not here to protect anybody. I'm not here to diminish anybody. So my job there is purely a record keeper. So
yeah.
That being said, it's digital manipulation, whether no matter what your motivations are, whether they're selfish motivations and you want to put two pictures together to make a great picture to enhance your career, or whether it's because my girlfriend's mom is going to be really mad if she's seen at this demonstration, so I'm going to fuzz her face.
Right.
Any one of those is not a genuine and does not outweigh truth. So I see that as digital manipulation.
Well, I think that's okay. A good clarification there, because I mean, so for someone that doesn't really come from the newspaper journalism background, that's exactly what I thought. But it's good to hear that you kind of confirm that.
Well, it's as if you could argue the other side of the coin. You know, the policemen want to see who's at your demonstration. Show us your negatives.
True.
Well, no, I'm not going to do that either, because that's not my job. I'm not law enforcement. I am a record. You know, I am there to record. And, you know, so there's all sorts of arguments about that.
Right.
But as far as going out to demonstrations, and I would always, I'd always be looking for a way out. I mean, this is true with any kind of dangerous situation, whether it's a brush fire or a riot or, you know, even a mosh pit at a concert. You know, you've got to kind of keep an eye on your exit. You know, how do I get out of this? If stuff starts going south, what do I do? And so that's the number one. Number two is prepare yourself with the proper gear, you know, whether that's a helmet or, you know, some kind of shield, face masks, stuff like that.
Did you
ethically,
ever...
go ahead.
No, I was going to say, did you ever feel like you were in serious danger during your times?
Yeah, when I covered the riots in South Central after Rodney King.
Yeah.
It was that first night was pretty scary. And the naivete that I went up there with, you know, thinking, well, you know, I even hate saying it. But, you know, it was like, well, you know, I'm from Southern California. It'll be all right.
Right.
Yeah. What? Right. Jesus. And then, you know, like within 5 minutes, my windshield is cracked from a big rock. And I figure, well, this is not going the way I expected.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but as long as you keep your head and try to watch out, you know, kind of if whenever possible. The first night I was out there by myself. And the next night, I talked to, you know, I was by myself, and then Paul Rodriguez, who is my colleague at the Orange County Register, was at the police station down in what they called Parker Center. And he was down there by himself, and we both talked the next morning and said, let's team up. And so what we learned from that first night was one of us is going to drive and one of us is going to shoot, and then we're going to rotate, and then the other one's going to shoot, and then the other one's going to drive. So
right.
It's just, you know, being with people who have shared interest in what they want to do for the story and what their motivation and what they hope their reward is, working together so that that's achieved safely.
Right. Do you have, is there an ethical line here between trying to show people when you're capturing something that's very hot button, like political rallies, social protests, is there a line of trying to, because sometimes you need to come in with a voice, or do you not recommend doing that at all? Do you just say go document, or what? Like, what's your take on that situation?
What do you mean come in with a voice?
Like, if your goal is to show one side being sympathetic or one side being, you know, you can wait. You could sit on a moment where you're going to show somebody in the most negative light possible. You can also sit on a moment until they show something that is very sympathetic. So I'm curious as to is that something that ethically crosses a line?
Well, I think it does if that's what your intention is.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm. I can't say that I've felt that way about something, you know, when I'm covering an event. If I'm not, you know, like, I'm trying to think of an example, but I'm just looking for pictures.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember this, what photographers are doing this summer is going through their old stuff. And I was looking, I found a picture that I hadn't thought of in a while, but this was a demonstration. This was during Iran-Contra, which, you know, a lot of people were probably too young to know what that is. But there was a demonstration, and I was photographing it, and two sides were going at each other, and both of them were convinced that I was working for the other. And I remember telling them that both these guys are in my ear, you know, and I just said, hey, you know, I'm here for the pictures. That's right. All I'm here for. I'm here for the pictures. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you hit him over the head with a sign, you're going to look bad. But I have no partiality in that. That's just a fact. Mm-hmm. Or if the other guy hits the other person with a sign, same thing. I'm here for the pictures. And I think it's a good place to stay. And you avoid what we were just talking about with blurring out faces and all that other stuff, because then you become part of the story.
Right.
And you shouldn't be.
And, you know, maybe now more than ever, I'd say that people seem to be responding more combatively to photographers taking their picture in public settings, especially if children are involved. Yeah. And, you know, I guess the interest comes down to like what rights are, but you know, some of these reactions are justified. Some might fall into the category of hypersensitive. Do you have advice for photographers who are just trying to like work on making pictures? You know, they're going out and they're just photographing their community, and then they run into a situation where they're being confronted. How do you articulate to people what your objectives are and what your rights are?
Well, I've run into that. You can't really get into constitutional law with a lot of folks.
Right.
You know, and explain to them that you're on a street, so I can take your picture. You also can't deny a parent their concern with having their kids' pictures taken. Mm-hmm. So just a couple of practices I had is if I knew I was out like at the beach and I was there to shoot hot weather, and that would involve maybe a kid picture. I always made sure I had as much gear as I could on. I mean, I look like a photographer. I look like a newspaper guy. I made sure my credentials were around my neck. And I wouldn't ask the kid for his name. I'd say, tell me where your mom is. And I'd go immediately to them and talk to them. Now, I wouldn't always do that ahead of time, because I think it spoils the moment, because no sooner do you ask a parent a kid's name, the parent is directing the kid. And so I would tend to do that afterwards. There was an opportunity, or there was a situation where the register wanted me to go shoot this new park opening. And it was 11 o'clock in the morning on like a Wednesday. And I was walking in there, middle-aged guy. And there was like 10, you know, parent kids in there. And I just announced it. And I just walked in there and I said, I'm with the Orange County Register, and we're doing a story on this park. And if you don't want your kid photographed, just let me know.
Right.
And what happened in that case is they had the opportunity and they knew who I was. But they also forgot about me. And so I was able to capture kind of real pictures after that announcement.
That's so a good idea. So that worked out well that way. Reminds me, you mentioned something about getting names. I've always been curious, are there situations that require the photographer to ask for a subject's name versus situations where it's not necessary?
Well, it used to be pretty damn mandatory. You know, we wouldn't run a picture without a name on it. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed, as the numbers start to build on how many pictures people produce, some pictures don't have names on them that would ordinarily have names on them. So maybe that's loosening. I can't say that for sure. I'm just, you know, now I'm an outsider looking back. But at the time, you know, when I was working, you always had to have a name.
Right.
And there are pictures that didn't run of mine because I couldn't get a name or they wouldn't give me a name. And so, yeah, I, you know, it's one of the, to be honest with you, Mike, one of the nicest things about shooting at the fair is I shoot those kind of pictures, but I don't have to worry about names.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, so you're not missing other pictures by running over and getting somebody's name.
Mm-hmm.
And so, so yeah, we had to get names, and I think it adds a certain credibility to a photograph to have names. I think it shows that there's a partnership in that the person is willing to give their name, and so kind of it's their consent that this picture is legit.
How has your perception of breaking into the photojournalism industry changed over the years, if at all?
Well, I don't know if it's my perception as much as it is a new reality. You know, when I was looking for work, I had a job. You know, that job where I went and shot the wood carver with the chainsaw. I had that job a month after I graduated from college, and I never looked back. I was never unemployed until I left newspapers. I was always working. That's not the same business that we have now. It's not the, you know, things are tough. So my perception is that things are tough. My training, or what I would say to that is, ask me that question again, will you please?
Yeah. I would say how is breaking into photojournalism changed over the course of time? Have you seen any difference?
Yeah. The market is really hard, okay. But the wage you break into photojournalism hasn't changed.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, again, that word, that T word, tenacity, the willingness to just work your ass off. And that doesn't always necessarily mean blood, sweat, and tears. What that means is being willing to look for pictures when everybody else has gone home. Right. And to find angles and things that no one else had thought of. And I still think that's the way you break into this business. There just aren't as many avenues for that to be appreciated. And that's hard.
So for the young people that are kind of gearing up to kind of break into this industry, what do you find? And you've seen a lot of pictures, you've seen a lot of portfolios. What are the most common traits of like a good portfolio, one that stands out? Because there's so much noise out there now.
Well, I think a good portfolio is only as good as your weakest picture. So always be looking to get rid of your weakest picture and replace it with a better one. And another thing I would recommend with portfolios is have people look at it. You know, you are not the best judge of your work.
Right.
And so be sure that you have people whose opinions you appreciate and people you relate to look at your pictures. I mean, there's certainly people. I mean, I've heard stories of people out there who just take pleasure in diminishing or castrating someone's work for the fun of it, you know, or what they think is teaching. But I think honey is better than salt as far as that goes. Mm-hmm. And you can teach to see better pictures by how you look at the pictures they've already made. And so you're looking for people like that. You're not looking for people who are just going to be a hard ass and not really give you anything back.
Right.
But be willing, you know, if you know there's a photographer out there, there's just nothing wrong with Paul Rodriguez's pictures. I think his pictures are just amazing. And so I always bounce things off him. I bounce things off Matt Brown. I bounce things off Wally Scully. I bounce things off people who I respect the hell out of. And I think that's where you go, and don't take it as a personal insult. You know, grow some skin, you know, grow a little callus and be willing to hear some things you may not find pleasurable. And if you want someone to tell you how great your portfolio is, go to your mom.
Right.
or your girlfriend who knows that you're going to be in a bad mood if she doesn't tell you the greatest thing in the world. So, you know, be honest with yourself and your portfolio will get a lot better.
Do you think there's like a sweet spot in terms of like the number of images that you put on your portfolio or in your book? Is it better to go shorter and smaller than, let's say, having 30 pictures?
Well, I think with any job or any kind of, I don't think one portfolio fits all. I think you have to research the people you're interviewing with and who you're going to be showing your portfolio to. I'm sure you, you know, it's a different portfolio between showing it to the Orange County Fair and showing it to the Associated Press. Mm-hmm. Every entity has its own needs and its own wish list of what they want out of a photographer. So to offer the same thing to everybody is not going to help you. So I don't know if there's a real set number or answer to that question.
Right.
Other than by what your research yields, and even down to who the photo editor is who's looking at your work, or who the creative editor is who's looking at your work, be aware of that. But I would, you know, given my rant earlier about how many pictures we're seeing, I would go lighter.
Right. I would make an impact with smaller amount.
Yeah. Because if you start to dilute your pool, you start to hurt yourself. And I think if you have 20 powerful pictures there and you throw 5 or 6 more in there just to kind of give it some number, you're only shooting yourself in the foot.
Yeah. I also, to add to that, I think that the attention span is so much shorter that a lot of editors probably don't want to look through your 40 pictures that you have on your website. They might want to see the first 5 and then say, we have enough information.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So you might as well make them as condensed as possible. You've spent a lot of time, you know, not just in the classroom, but also in the field, you know, especially through the workshop that we've both been a part of. When you're in the field with students and they're photographing, what do you think is the most common issue that you really see that photographers are making that is preventing them from making good pictures? And what's the easy fix there? What's the most common trait?
You know, if I could do one thing, I mean, I do this as a lesson before we shoot black and white film, because I teach film photography in my high school class, which is another major reason I wanted that job, because I just think it's the best possible way to make pictures, you know, to learn to make pictures is through black and white, you know, through processing and all that. But I would say the one thing that to answer all those needs that you just brought up is quit chimping. Quit looking at your pictures, you know, look at them, but don't always be looking at them. There are people who have that function where you can shoot a picture and it shows up on your back screen of your camera. The first thing I do is I tell them to turn that off. I said, you need to be in a moment. You can't be an outsider looking in. You have to be someone who lets the moment wash over you. And if you're stopping that moment to look at the back of your camera, then you're losing opportunities to make great pictures. I mean, it just stands to reason, if you're not looking up to make pictures, you're missing them by looking down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the temptation is incredible. But what I do when we, as a step, out of, you know, because what I, the way I teach my high school class is we learn, you know, what's a good picture, composition, light, depth of field, shutter speed, all that stuff. And then we go into black and white photography. And because you have less opportunity, you know, you don't have the pray and spray kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So what I do is when we make that transition, we still shoot, I mean, before we shoot with the film cameras, I tape over all the windows on the back of the digital cameras.
I was going to ask you if you gaffers tape people's, you know, viewfinder. Yeah.
I do. And I say, now let's go make pictures, because this is the way you're going to be making pictures with that film camera.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to be able to look at the back of it. You're going to have to understand in your mind what you're making. And that in itself, that's why I love the film camera so much, is because you have to conceptualize what the picture is that you want. And, you know, a lot of photography these days is done by just hammering the motor drive and finding something within that pile. Whereas with film, it's much more deliberate, and it's a discipline that helps you make pictures. It just helps you make pictures.
Yeah, exactly. You know, going to your teaching aspect, how has teaching young journalists shape your perspective on the art form, on photojournalism? Has it re-energized your passion for it? Has it made you think differently? Have you learned anything as a result from teaching a curriculum?
Well, I think, first off, walking students, you know, first couple of years of this, walking through students through the whole process brought me back to where I was learning the process and things that I'd forgotten or, you know, just ignored or whatever. And I started applying some of those principles that I teach, and that, you know, with the experience that I have and re-exploring those principles, I really like the pictures I've been making. So you're never too old to relearn. I think what I see in the craft and in the students is gives me hope, and there's a lot of desire and passion out with the younger photographers that I wouldn't have thought was there, and it's not dissimilar from when I walked into a classroom 40 years ago to learn this. So I feel good about that. And they need to be trained. You know, they need to not fuzz people's faces from protests and things like that. But in general, they really have the desire to and want to be journalists. And thank God.
Yeah.
Because we really need them.
We need it. I'm curious, what were one or two of the forgotten principles that you really rediscovered as you started teaching?
Oh, you know, just simple things like composition or looking for light, relating to subjects.
Yeah. Fundamental.
Yeah, like just principles. Really fundamental stuff that you kind of gloss over. It's, oh, yeah, I got that.
Right.
But, you know, it's just nice to, I mean, it's not like there was any kind of detriment to, but I just feel more, I feel like I've kind of gotten back to things I'd forgotten. So.
Right. Well, one of the things is
learning and hearing myself say this stuff over and over again, like I do when I teach, it gives me an appreciation. Looking at my own work and kind of going where at one time I looked at that picture and was like, ah, I wish I'd done this. I wish I'd done that. And then like today I look at it and go, that's a pretty damn nice picture. So it's just a, it's what's relative at the time.
Yeah. I do find that to be the case oftentimes, is that if you give yourself time, you remove yourself from the immediacy of making a picture that you felt was underwhelming. You come back to it, it's not as bad as you made it out to be in your mind, right? You know, one of the things that I liked about what you do with your students is you kind of give them these abstract assignments. You know, you give them a concept and then they go out and make a picture out of it. Walk me through that process.
Well, that was, you know, I normally do an assignment towards the end of the year where we learn to make proof sheets in Photoshop. And I give them the scavenger hunt, and normally it's a list of words or phrases, and they need to go out and illustrate it. And normally I have them pair up, but in this case, because of the virus, we were all home, and it worked out really, really well because it gave them distraction from everything else. And the kids who bought into it hard, and it was really very exciting. I mean, I would tell them, and it's absolutely true, the best thing I would do during a day would be looking at their pictures and trying to decide which ones I should put up on the Instagram. But my belief in teaching photography is doing photography. You know, I'm a self-taught photographer. That guy at Thornton Community College at 7 o'clock in the morning showing me his cruise ship pictures was just an entry point. I mean, what I learned there was I love making pictures, and what I learned was the more I took pictures, the better I got at it. So the more I love taking pictures. So it's a lot. I'm sure musicians and artists and writers and all that, you know, feel, you know, all those expressive arts feel the same way. But I think the best way to by far is be shooting pictures.
Yeah.
Always be shooting. Just always, you know, take your camera with you. It not only is it rewarding for you, but you know, you have a camera with you, your vacations get more rich, and you know, your life experiences get more rich and all that stuff. You know, your pictures of your kids are better.
Yeah. I think there's such a lesson there, and one that I need to remind myself of a lot of times too. Cause like, you know, the last couple of years, you know, I really kind of stepped away from a lot of personal work because I was so fixated on making profit, you know, and doing work that was going to pay me and all this. But it, I could feel the drought, like the creative drought, and every picture that I've ever made that I think is worth a darn is actually a personal shot. You know, it's not something that I was paid to do. And so I think there's a lesson there, to always just keep shooting, always keep creating.
Well, there's, Annie Leibovitz, to come back to her for a moment, she'll tell you she learned to make pictures by photographing her family. You know, she came from a military family, and they bounced around the country. She learned her craft in the dark room that was at the rec center of the Air Force base in the Philippines while her father would do bombing runs into Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So that's where she learned to make her pictures. And she stresses that still. I watched a master class of hers like 6 months ago. And she says, use your family, make photography personal, and it will enrich you. And I think that's very true. And, you know, I'm sitting at a desk. I've just created a little office space in my house, and I'm looking at all the pictures around me, and they're all personal. They're not, you know, Michael Phelps all pumped up. It's my kids and riding a bike.
Right.
And all that stuff. And they're really good because I know what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And it just makes it all the better.
And
so
Matt tells me that, or has mentioned that many times, and I always think that's a great piece of advice. Is like, if you can photograph your family, like, you'll never have a harder time really on assignment, because like photographing your mom or your father, and it's like, why couldn't you photograph me when I was younger? And you know, dressed up, and now you're doing this now. If you can break that barrier down, and that's a really great skill set to develop. I think that's a great piece of advice.
Yeah. Well, I know Matt loves to, he'll tell you that one of the hardest subjects to photograph is your mom.
Yeah.
You know, cause they never think they look good.
Right. And they're like, why are you doing this?
Mm-hmm. She goes, I hate having my picture taken, cause I see myself as a 35-year-old woman. Mm-hmm. And then you turn around and show me these pictures that show me as the 75-year-old woman that I am.
Right. Yeah.
And I don't like it. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, it's interesting, Michael, is I don't like it.
Sure.
You know,
hey, listen.
Me and I go, God, I look like that.
Listen, I'm 37. I don't like it myself anymore either. So I understand. Yep.
Yeah. So it's a good training ground, especially if you got little brothers, or you got brothers and sisters who are coming after you.
Yeah. What's been your favorite piece of advice that you think you ever got?
I don't know. I guess one that's kind of motivated me is that, you know, it's going to sound kind of crummy, but I think it's true, is that someone's going to get that assignment. So why can't it be you? Right. So I would advocate for myself a lot, particularly when I was at newspapers. I would produce. I mean, I wouldn't take it and come back with schlocky work, but I would advocate for myself to get good assignments, to do things that I really thought were important, good, exciting, different things to do. And if I would do something like that and fail, then I wouldn't get it the next time. But so I always thought that I just to advocate for yourself is good advice. Don't sit there and wait in line. You know, don't be a jerk. Don't do awful stuff. But there's nothing wrong with saying, hey, I really like to do that, or I want to be a part of this, or you know, I think I could. You know, the last time I did this, you really liked it, so let's do it again. You know, that kind of thing. So advocating for yourself, I think, was good advice. And always be shooting is also good advice. You know, just, you know, even I was never one to not work when I, you know, in a newspaper, sometimes, you know, it can be really, really busy, and sometimes it can just be dead. And particularly like in the summertime when schools are out and stuff, there was nothing going on. I'd make a point of always be shooting. I always be out there every day looking for weather art, looking for something I can make a picture with, you know, remembering places that were cool that might be nice at a different time of day. And I'd go back there, you know, so always being proactive. As far as, you know, advice per se, I don't know that I really ever got that.
Do you feel like there's ever some advice that you wish you had gotten, something that you learned just through the hardships of, you know, life experience later on that you wish, hey, man, that would have saved me a lot of heartache if somebody had told me this earlier?
Well, if someone had told me to buy Apple earlier, mm-hmm. that would have saved me a lot of heartache.
There you go. Yep.
I think business side of it, you know, I wish that, you know, I'd been a little bit more pushed towards knowing that. I mean, you always heard it and you hear it still, and it's still solidly valid. And you're a prime example of someone who heeded the call and paying good attention to it is the business side of this. You know, there's a lot of photographers out there, but they'd be better off as businessmen. You know, I certainly fall into that category. So that's one thing I wish. What's another one? I don't know. No. Yeah. You know,
that's good.
I can't think of anything offhand. But you know, the knowing the business, which is, you know, Todd Bigelow does a great job with that in his workshop. And you are a prime example of someone who's been able to meld their vision with business, which is admirable, and I respect the heck out of you for it. And so that'd probably be it. You know, I mean, I've got a good life. I got my kids I just would kill for, and I got a good house and a great wife who's also a journalist. So we've lived together without imploding.
Yeah.
And you know, the word side versus the picture side.
Right.
She's a writer.
Nice.
So it's all pretty good.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in the end, that's all you can really ask for.
Yeah.
Mike, this has been such a wonderful conversation for me, just selfishly, just listening to you talk. I've got one last question for you before I let you go. Sure. You know, today's younger generation, the students, the aspiring journalists out there, they will invariably face a competitive and saturated industry, one that has been known to knock people down on their asses and maybe never stop punching. So, you know, is there a message, a piece of counsel that you think is important to remind them of as they embark on this journey?
Well, I think it's a journey in, not just with photography, but I think in general is to believe in yourself and to believe in what you're doing. It's said a lot, but I think it still doesn't make it less true that, you know, your passion will get you a lot of things, and to follow your passion. Figure out a way to make that passion work for you. I know right now it's hard because everybody's, you know, business is tough. I know a lot of freelance photographers who just are really in dire straits, but they're still shooting and they're still trying to keep it going. But I think, you know, we keep coming back to that word, it's tenacity and just a willingness to not let go. And to keep, if this is what you want to do, do it. You know, it sounds like a cop out to say that.
No, not at all. Yeah, I couldn't have said it better myself, because you know that really is going to be the. I think it's the thing that's going to determine whether you stay in this or not. There are too many people I can count on multiple hands, and I can see their faces when they've told me that I shouldn't be doing this. And, you know, it's not like a, I want to prove them wrong necessarily, but it does motivate you. And it's, you got a little chip. And so those are important sometimes to just know that, you know, staying with it, if it's important to you, if it makes you the best version of yourself, I think that's right. Really, really, really important to follow through on that and not just go for plan B.
Right.
Yeah. Is there anything that you would like to plug? Is there anything that we can plug for you, or what do you got going on?
Oh, I got no plug. Just, come to Cal State Long Beach and get taught photojournalism or nothing. That's kind of what, I like about the teaching, is it becomes about the students. And I don't have anything going like that right now.
Well, that, I think that's important. And I thank you so much for your time, Mike. It was just a blast having you here.
Just make me sound smart, will you, Michael?
I'll do my best. I have no promises. All right. That's going to wrap it up for us today. Thank you guys for tuning in. Thank you for being part of the Media 1099 community. For everyone that has reached out to us, that has written us a review, we really appreciate your support. If you've enjoyed the show, help us out by sharing the episode on your social media platforms. I will be listing Mike's social media handles in the show notes as well. Be sure to give him a follow. And if you gained anything out of this conversation, just do me a favor, reach out to him and just say thank you for all that he has done and what he continues to do for this industry. Thank you, folks. We'll see you on the next episode.